Mark Gauguin. This is number 0304, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0304. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Dave Berg, former executive producer of The Tonight Show, and author of Behind the Curtain, An Insider's View of Jay Leno's Tonight Show. Leno didn't seem to get the respect normally given to the number one late-night talk show host.
He was not the darling of the media. Starting from day one, going back to May of 1992, all the way through the end, the media pundits would refer to Letterman as the king of late night. He went out the king of late night. The fact of the matter is, and I'm a little biased, Letterman's final show pulled in 13.76 million viewers, and Jay's pulled in 14.5 million viewers. So you don't get to be called the king of late night unless you have the most viewers.
Former mobster Louis Ferrante, author of The 3-Pound Crystal Ball, How the Dreaming Brain Can See the Future.
I had the idea in prison. I was always intrigued by time once I was locked up, and I realized that that was my enemy. I guess it's all of our enemy. We're always fighting against time and looking for, the fountain of youth, and we want to always save every day we can as we get to age. And in prison, you really, really feel strongly that time is something that, you know, you're up against.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter splashes into summer with the delightful Underwater Babies. So get your water wings ready and make a splash later on the Stuff File Program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0304, was Mark Gauguin, a freelance voice announcer and a former colleague of mine. Thank you very much, Mark, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, there are many people who just want a lot of peace and quiet when they're at home. They don't like to hear kids playing or lawnmowers running or the ice cream truck coming down the street. They just want to chill out. And apparently, what is the most heinous noise that can drive a neighbor over the edge? How about laundry? You know, the constant rinsing, the spinning, the folding. Oh, so noisy. If you have a neighbor like that, apparently there is only one thing left to do. Kidnapping. Yes. A Vero Beach, Florida man is accused of abducting a neighbor after he claimed the woman and her husband were being too loud in their laundry room. Authorities with the Vero Beach Police Department said 61-year-old Leon Thurston entered the laundry room of Jessica Scoville's home with a black baton and a handgun. Investigators said Scoville's husband, David Scoville, was hit twice with a baton before Thurston grabbed Jessica by the wrist and took her from the home. David then called police for help. A search was then launched for Jessica when she flagged down police near Charles Park at around 7:30 a.m. Thurston was taken into custody, and officials said the gun was found in his pants. Oh, so I guess he just wasn't happy to see them. Jessica told authorities she asked Thurston to use a restroom and was able to get away and find help. Thurston faces numerous charges, including armed burglary, aggravated battery, and kidnapping. I hope when he's convicted and goes to jail, he ends up on the prison laundry detail. Yeah, that would be ironic justice, don't you think? Yeah. Now, before you plan on having sex, make sure you wine and dine the object of your affections, and above all, make sure you know nay means nay. According to police in Edinburgh, Texas, 45-year-old Cirillo Castillo was rushed to hospital before being arrested after breaking his leg while having sex with a horse. Edinburgh police said that they have arrested Castillo, who has a history of sex with animals, after he was found injured in a barn in Edinburgh. An ambulance took him to a hospital for treatment after he was found at around 7 a.m. by the owner of the barn while she was feeding her animals. Now, she had warned him to stay away from the barn after a previous arrest for having sex with her horses. Castillo said that he was hit by a car and got into the barn for shelter, but investigators believed he was kicked by a horse. He was charged with trespassing. Castillo could face up to 180 days in jail if convicted. Castillo has two previous convictions for having sex with horses. Gee, just what kind of pickup line do you use on a horse anyway? Perhaps, "Hey, baby, why the long face?" A 44-year-old Florida man was arrested after he allegedly called 911 to brag about his big muscles and asked the dispatcher on a date, police said. Eduardo Edward Garcia was camping at Lake Griffin State Park in Fruitland Park, Florida, about 50 miles, rather, from Orlando, when he called 911 to report a harassing phone call he received. Now, while on the phone, he asked the female dispatcher if she was single and told her that he had big muscles. He called back twice more after the dispatcher hung up on him. Officers went to the park where Garcia was camping and found him lying in his tent with an open can of beer and three more cold ones by his side. Officers called a phone number the 911 calls had originated from, and the phone by Garcia rang. Now, while in handcuffs in the police cruiser, Garcia allegedly told the officer he wanted to headbutt and kill him. He also spit at one of the officers, police said, and Garcia is being held on charges of battery on a law enforcement officer and misuse of the 911 system. Well, clearly he has a few anger management issues, which leads me to question just how did he get those big muscles? As we all know, there are some nasty personality side effects in steroid use. I'm just speculating. And moving right along, police in China released CCTV video of a drunken man posing as an officer in an attempt to secure the release of a friend who turned out not to be in custody. Investigators said the man came into the Yangjing police station in Zhengjiang province on June the 1st, shortly after 21 people were arrested in an illegal gambling sting and claimed to be a police officer from Chengdu. Now, officials said the man, who smelled strongly of alcohol, told the Yangjing officers he was looking for one of the suspects arrested in the sting to transport him to another facility. However, police were suspicious of the man's story, and he eventually admitted that he was posing as an officer in an attempt to have his friend released from custody. The man, who said he learned police procedures when he was previously working as a police assistant, admitted to his deception in court and was jailed for 5 days. Police said the friend the suspect was attempting to free turned out not to be among those arrested in the sting. Well, you know, one has to do what one can do to help your friends. I mean, his heart was in the right place, but his head clearly was not. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 44-year-old Kristen Radecki of Cape Coral, Florida, was caught on video dancing, accompanied by music blasting in his car, including Hall & Oates' Rich Girl and Supertramp's Goodbye Stranger. It made the news because of where Radecki was dancing, on the roof of a marked Lee County Sheriff's Patrol car. When he was done, he allegedly broke the vehicle's windshield wipers and stole an American flag from someone's yard. When contacted by police, Radecki denied being on alcohol or drugs, but said the event was triggered by a woman with fangs who said there was to be human sacrifice to vampires. Therefore, Radecki made the conscious decision to get the Sheriff of Nottingham to help him stop the slaughter of small children. Wow. And by the way, everything I just said is actually written down in the police report. Radecki, who has a record that includes sex offenses, was charged with disturbing the peace and criminal mischief. He was checked out at a hospital and given a medical clearance to be jailed because, you know, when children face death, rational people bust out 70s rock hits. Yeah, yeah. My question is, how was he cleared by the hospital? That had to be a very low bar set for that test. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Dave Berg is a former executive producer of NBC's The Tonight Show, back when it was hosted by Jay Leno. He has now written an insider's guide to his years on the show in a book called Behind the Curtain, an insider's view of Jay Leno's Tonight Show. Dave joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program. So Jay hosted the show for 17 years. Were you there for most of that time?
I was. He hosted actually 22, and I was there for 18.
Okay. Now, he was there for a long period of time. He was the number one late-night host. He left as the number one host. But it seems like, at least in the media, he doesn't necessarily get the respect of being the number one host. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that. He was not the darling of the media. Starting from day one, going back to, you know, May of 1992, all the way through the end, the media pundits would refer to Letterman as the king of late night. The king, he went out the king of late night. The fact of the matter is, and I'm a little biased, Letterman's final show pulled in 13.76 million viewers, and Jay's pulled in 14.5 million viewers. So you don't get to be called the king of late night unless you have the most viewers.
So why do you think that perception is there?
Well, I think that the critics took Jay's approach to comedy, which was to be sort of be the blue-collar guy, appeal to everybody, including all the flyover states in the middle of the country, or the middle of the world, however you want to put it. And Letterman was the edgy comic, the guy that had an attitude, which appealed to them.
Mm. Now, so you've now written this book, Behind the Curtain. What is it that you want the general population to know about the workings of The Tonight Show that we didn't necessarily hear during Jay's tenure?
Well, I think just all the stuff that the critics kind of left out, and I've already made the point. My point is the guy that gets the most viewers gets to be called the king of late night. Jay left an amazing legacy in his own right. It wasn't just Letterman that left a legacy. Jay left a legacy, which was that I believe he did the monologue of record. He expanded it from Johnny's 7 minutes to 14 minutes. He made it far more political than Johnny had it, and he never got credit for that. And also, he was the first one to bring to late night, you know, not just guests in entertainment, but people from the political world, people from the world of sports, people from the world of news.
Those who are old enough to remember the earlier incarnations of The Tonight Show, I'm just wondering, do you get the feeling that Jay kind of gets lost in the shuffle, much in the same way that Jack Parr gets lost between Steve Allen and Johnny Carson?
Well, I think so, and I think, again, it goes. They say history belongs to the people that write it, and it's the media critics that happen to write the history of late night, and I think that's what's going on there, and I agree with you.
Now, one of the turning points, or at least what people refer to as one of the major turning points in Jay's tenure when he grabbed number one and held on to it for the rest of his run, was when Hugh Grant showed up. In your estimation, was that really a big turning point, or was it just slow and steady wins the race and that kind of grabs some attention?
Actually, it's a little bit of both. Because up until that day when Hugh Grant was booked, which was July 10th, 1995, up until that date, Letterman had been number one, and he had been number one from the day he went on the air in 1993 until that date. The pundits had already written off Jay, and they even said that the late night war is over. David Letterman is the winner. But the fact of the matter is, Jay had kind of tweaked the show, added a little more comedy, more monologue jokes, a little less time with the guests, and was slowly creeping up on Letterman. But definitively, on July 10th, he won the night. He had like 12 to 13 million viewers. Normally, we brought in, five million viewers, and definitively beat Letterman, and was number one from that point going forward for almost two decades.
So let's go behind the curtain, as your book implies. We all know that Jay was, well, unceremoniously dumped and replaced by Conan, only to come back. And when you think about it, dumped again, because neither retirement was necessarily Jay's own doing, correct?
He was fired two times, just to put it bluntly. He got fired twice.
So what is it about the NBC executives that deem it necessary to want to get rid of what is essentially the number one late show host in America on two occasions?
I know it. It seems a little odd, but I kind of have to give the executives credit the second time around. They had worked with Jay, and I think Jay had come to terms with it. And it turned out that the guy that replaced him, Jimmy Fallon, has climbed to number one, has reinvented the show for the new generation. So I don't think he has a lot of issues with that one. But the Conan replacing him, I think he and the rest of us at the show did have issues with that.
Mm. Do you think? I mean, again, he went out as number one, but there's that public perception. Do you think, as time goes on, much like with this book, Behind the Curtain, that Jay's star will actually rise, much like how former presidents always seem better once they're removed from office?
I know, there was a poll recently, and I know you're in Canada, but there was a poll recently that George Bush is more popular than Barack Obama, and which is really weird, very strange. And I certainly hope that happens. That's really the primary reason I wrote the book, was to sort of set the record straight about Jay.
Mm. So what's the biggest misconception that you feel you needed to straighten out with your book, Behind the Curtain?
Well, this idea that David Letterman sort of owned comedy, that he redefined late night, and it simply wasn't true. Jay brought his own legacy to late night. He brought a lot of firsts to late night.
Mm. So give us some, in your estimation, some of the highlights. I already talked about the Hugh Grant thing. What are some of the highlights that you remember fondly, either what we saw or what took place backstage during your tenure with Jay?
Well, I think the quintessential highlight, I think the defining moment for Jay, and it's almost hard to appreciate the significance of this, was that President Barack Obama came on the show on his 59th day in office as president. That was truly a first in late night. It was a radical approach. Today, of course, the president appears on all types of media, but up until that point, sitting presidents, never, ever appeared on a late night show because it was considered unpresidential, it was considered undignified. But the president, Obama, decided he wanted to do late night, and he happened to choose Jay. So that was the most significant, I think, thing that happened.
Now, was that a situation where you and the staff of The Tonight Show asked the president to appear, and had you asked previous presidents in the past to appear?
Yes, we had. But in the case of Mr. Obama, this was an effort that I had started making 5 years earlier at the Democratic Convention in 2004, when John Kerry was the standard bearer. But there was this little known senator from Illinois who gave the keynote speech named Barack Obama. And I watched that and I said, oh my gosh, this is the most talented communicator in politics since Ronald Reagan. The next day, I started calling his staff and forming a relationship. 5 years later, we were able to book him as president.
Wow. Did you take bets on the presidency while you were at it?
That he would do it? No, I thought the odds were totally against us, but I thought, why not? Let's give it a shot.
No, I mean on the odds that he would become president, because you seem to know 5 years before everyone else did.
Well, it's just he was so electrifying. I don't know if you ever saw that speech, but it was an electrifying speech, and it brought the country together. It was a truly amazing speech.
One of the other things that I remember watching The Tonight Show that I really enjoyed, and sadly, they have since broken up, but Angie Harmon and Jason Sehorn getting engaged on the show.
And I truly have to say, I'm so sorry that they have broken up. But that was the truth of the matter is, there's not a lot of spontaneity in television. We all know at this point, reality shows aren't reality shows. They're scripted. There's very little spontaneity, and in all honesty, that includes late night. For instance, I don't know what questions you're going to ask me, right? I don't know what you're going to ask, but in late night, the guests often do. But this moment, when Jason Sehorn got down on his knee and came out and proposed to Angie Harmon, she didn't know what was coming, and it was one of those rare spontaneous moments in late night on our show and in all of late night.
How much input or how much cooperation did you have in putting this book together with Jay?
The main collaboration is that he gave it his blessing by agreeing to write the foreword.
Okay.
And he even said that he in the foreword that he wasn't going to read the book till it came out, which sort of acknowledged that he knew that he probably would disagree with me about a lot of the stuff in the book. So all I can say is thank you, Jay.
The book is called Behind the Curtain, which is a story of Jay Leno's Tonight Show. It's written by Dave Berg. And Dave, what are you doing now? You were the former executive producer of that show.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm primarily a writer these days. I'm a columnist for the Orange County Register in Southern California, and I actually write things for politicos, and because I sort of, you know, that's a world I'm familiar with, the political world.
Well, it certainly was a golden age of late night TV for all those years that Jay ruled the roost. Again, the book is called Behind the Curtain, and Dave, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I thank you, Peter.
Former Tonight Show executive producer Dave Berg, author of Behind the Curtain, an insider's view of Jay Leno's Tonight Show. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0304, and you'll find links to Dave's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Louis Ferrante, the author of The 3-Pound Crystal Ball. Plus, Stuart Nolman is back on the program with another edition of Book Banter. And we have lots more stuff here in the Stuff File news. Plus, of course, an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, here's a quote. I got stabbed with scissors. Most likely, probably accidentally. That's a quote from Earl Wynn. His girlfriend, Josephine Smith, did it, he admits, but the St. Petersburg, Florida man refused to press charges. I love her, Wynn says. She's a sweet girl. She's actually the sweetest person I've ever met. Police still arrested Smith, however, for aggravated battery with a deadly weapon, in part because she has a history of violence. 4 years ago, she went up to a stranger and told the elderly man she was a vampire, then started to bite him, ripping pieces of his face off with her teeth. Ooh. The face-eating case was national news, and Smith spent 6 months in jail for it. Wynn's ex-wife says Smith previously threatened to do the same thing to Wynn. He has bite marks on top of older bite marks, says Marianne Wynn. And, you know, that last statement by Wynn's ex-wife begs to ask a major question, I think. I mean, if Earl Wynn's girlfriend is a face-eating freak and Wynn allegedly has bite marks on top of older bite marks, then how toxic was his previous marriage that he still prefers his current girlfriend over his ex? That's the $64,000 question, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, two brothers got into a fight in the front yard of their Orange County, Florida home. There's a lot of strange things going on in Florida, you know, always. One grabbed a brick and threatened to throw it at the other. The other also grabbed a brick. The first, Michael Remelius, allegedly threw his brick, hitting brother James Remelius in the leg. James allegedly let his fly and hit Michael in the face. The 52-year-old twins, yes, they're twins, were both charged with aggravated battery with a deadly weapon. Michael's bail was set at $20,000, while James's bail was set at $25,000, apparently because he had the better aim. And probably because Mom always liked Michael best, I'm guessing. You know, I thought it was only in soap operas that you came across evil twins, but apparently they're in Florida, too. Owner Aaron Rouse was feeding his python. And no, that's not a euphemism. He had an actual python, okay? Get your mind out of the gutter. His python's name is Winston. He was feeding Winston a tasty rat in May using barbecue tongs. When Winston got hold of the tongs, it would not let go. Rouse of Adelaide, Australia, decided not to engage in a tug of war, but when he returned, believing Winston would see no food value in the medical clamps, the tongs had been swallowed and were halfway through the snake's comically bloated body. After taking x-rays, that of course became internet attractions, a veterinarian in Adelaide University removed the tongs by surgery. Seriously, was the x-ray really needed in this case? And it kind of makes you wonder what Winston has been eating besides, you know, rats. Yeah. Silicon Valley code writers, speaking of eating, by the way, and engineers work long hours with apparently little time for food as we know it. Eating is time wasted, in the words of celebrity inventor Elon Musk. And normal meals are marketing facade, said another Valley bigwig. The New York Times reported in May that techies are eagerly scarfing down generic but nutrient-laden liquids like schmilk and people's chow, largely for ease of preparation to speed their return to work. The Times food editor described one product as oat flour washed down with the worst glass of milk ever. Pancake batter, according to a Times reporter. The supermarket staple Ensure, according to a food editor, it's fine wine compared to schmilk. Wow. If they feel eating is a waste of time, how do they feel about sleeping? Wouldn't you like to see these pale, shallowed-out zombies in their senior years after years and years and years of acting this way and never seeing any sun and working in labs everywhere? Wow. Anyway, how distracted are Americans? Well, let's check it out by the numbers, shall we? Air travelers last year left $675,000 in obviously spare change in airport screening bins, reported by the Transportation Security Administration in April. Of the cars reported stolen in 2014, 44,828 were with keys left inside them, according to an April National Insurance Crime Bureau release. And American credit card holders failed to claim about $4 billion, that's with a B, $4 billion in earned rewards each year, according to CardHub.com's 2015 Credit Card Rewards Report. So, draw your own conclusions. Perhaps these folks are spending too much time eating meals. Maybe the drones at Silicon Valley are having this right. I don't know. We have time for one more story? Yes. One more story here in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A Greyhound bus on a 21-and-a-half-hour route between New York City and Atlanta, Georgia, had to pull over in Virginia when the driver smells smoke. The 28 passengers quickly evacuated. Firefighters traced the problem to the luggage compartment under the bus. A stowaway had climbed in and apparently got bored. He lit a cigarette. 35-year-old Jason Pittman of Plainfield, New Jersey, was flown to a Washington, D.C. hospital in critical condition, and he is expected to survive, which is good because, you know, then the lesson wasn't wasted. I mean, seriously. I admit I'm an elitist, and a 21-and-a-half-hour Greyhound bus ride is completely out of the question for me, but traveling in the luggage compartment? Wow. There is no place on this planet that I would need to get to that badly. Not one. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Former mobster Louis Ferrante has been on the show before. We spoke to him about some of his previous books, such as Mob Rules, and also his television show, Inside the Gangster's Code. But this time, he's here for something completely different. His latest book is called The 3-Pound Crystal Ball, How the Dreaming Brain Can See the Future. And Louis joins us on the line right now from Florida. Hi, Louis.
Hey, how are you, Peter? Thanks for having me on your show again.
Thanks for being on the program. So this is a bit of a departure for what you've done in the past. Where did this idea come up for the book, The 3-Pound Crystal Ball?
So I had the idea in prison. I was always intrigued by time once I was locked up, and I realized that was my enemy. You know, there's sort of, I guess it's all of our enemy. We're always fighting against time and looking for you know, I guess the fountain of youth, and we want to always save every day we can as we get to age. And in prison, you really, really feel strongly that time is something that, you know, you're up against. And I was thinking a lot about it. And then what happened was I was reading Einstein, and Einstein's theory of relativity proved that that time is an illusion. Past, present, and future is all the same, according to Einstein. So I was amazed that, hey, wow, you know, people have given this a lot of thought. So I started to read a lot more about physics and psychology, along with the hundreds and then thousands of books I read in prison. And then one day I had a dream. I was waiting to, I won my federal appeal. I reversed my case myself after hiring and firing 7 attorneys. I studied law, reversed one of my cases, and this is obviously after I educated myself. And I had this dream waiting to hear back from the state court, because I had a federal case that I reversed. So I'm waiting to hear back from the state court, and I had this dream that I was in a tower, and the guard knocked on the tower. I was in the cell at the top of the tower, and the guard knocked on the cell door and said, hey, it's time to go. And I said, nah, you know what, I'll stay. I'm reading, and I had books all around me in the dream. And
down below me was this mechanical shark that was circling this moat that was around the tower. And the guard left, and I woke up, and I'm like, what the hell was that? You know, maybe I'm cracking up in here. I love reading so much that I don't even want to win my appeal. You know, I mean, where am I going to get a chance to read all these books? I read 18 hours a day in jail. I'm never going to have an opportunity like that in the real world. It's too demanding. You have to worry about the bills, the electric, car payments, mortgage, rent, et cetera. So that's what I thought about when I woke up, and I figured I just dismissed it as that, and I said I better get my head screwed on straight. I need to be free. You know, the hell with that. I'll figure out how to read outside. And by the way, where this happened was I had just gone through Clinton Dannemora where those guys escaped, and I stayed in there about a month before I went over to Adirondack Prison, which is up in that area as well, and that's where this dream occurred, in Adirondack Prison. So I'm up there in Adirondack. I'm sorry, the dream occurred right before I got to Adirondack. The following occurred in Adirondack. I get to Adirondack, and I'm sitting up there, and I'm wondering about this dream, and I had this incident where the officer, the guard on duty, calls Chow, and I stayed behind, and he comes and he walks around the tier block, makes sure nobody's bleeding to death somewhere in a cell. Why didn't you go to Chow? Or you're looking to steal something from someone else's cell. So the guard asked me, hey, Ferrante, you going to Chow? And I said, no, I'll pass, I'm reading. And it dawned on me that was exactly a dream, and this was the same exact incident in the dream. It was the same situation, and here I am in this third-story old building that's like a tower, and I look outside, and instead of that mechanical shark, there's a car with guards in it, a pickup truck, circling the perimeter of the prison. So the perimeter road, to me, struck me as the moat, and the mechanical shark was the pickup truck. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's exactly the dream. The guy in the dream was the same. The dialogue we had, that's weird. So I wanted to study dreams. So I went and I started with Sigmund Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams because I had read Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents and loved the book. So I figured I'll start with Freud. He's pretty smart. And when I read Freud, I had a lot of issues with it. There was a lot of things that I believed were true, but there was also a lot of things in there that I disagreed with. And one of them was this dream this guy Maury had. And Maury had a particular dream in which he was about to be guillotined during the French Revolution, and he goes through these whole things, these trials and stuff, and he's condemned to the guillotine. He's got his neck on the guillotine. The guillotine comes down, and bang, he wakes up, and his bed broke, and he fractures his cervical vertebrae in his neck. And he's like, oh, my gosh, you know, how did I have this whole lengthy dream that led to the guillotine, and at the same time, the bed broke? So I'm like, oh, my gosh, I had these dreams when I was young. I lived on a corner where there was a lot of car accidents, and I would constantly be having dreams prior to a car accident that I was at a NASCAR race or that something was happening, and then bang, the incident outside corresponds identically with the noise in my head, and I knew that there had to be something in it. Now, I'm not going to give the rest away because it's all in the book, but I did extensive research, and I connected all the dots between neuroscience and psychology and physics, and I laid out all the dreams that I recorded in prison, and I prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, and I do it like a court case, but I promise you, if I asked for a verdict from a jury, they would say I proved my case, and the experiments are yet to follow, which I'm working on now. But basically, I proved that the mind can indeed see the immediate future before it happens. And then it leaves us to wonder, if we could see the immediate future, how many of us have had dreams or deja vus where, you know, something, you know, a little further down the road is exposed and we're blown away by it. So if I could prove it happens within seconds, maybe we could prove it happens farther down the road in time to come. And that's it in a nutshell, Peter. I mean, that's the book. And I think, you know, you would love it. I you know, your listeners would. It's a lot of things that that people could relate to.
Now, we've had you, as I said, on the program in the past, and clearly, I mean, every time I talk to you, I marvel at the breadth of the things that you do, and now with this book, it's an entirely different direction, and clearly, you have done everything you can to educate yourself. Having said that, the first words out of my mouth when I introduced you were former mobster. Now, I know you talk about having been in prison, but do you feel that you have somehow moved away from that, but the world doesn't let you?
So I still see guys, now and then. I'll give you an example. I'm down in Florida. Why, you know, the area I'm in, this guy down here, he was a former boss of a family. He's a great guy. He left the life. I know he left the life. And so I, you know, him and I, we took a day where I'm, you know, I'm at it every day. I'm either writing or doing something every day. I still work 18 hours a day. And I read 18 hours a day in jail. I still work that many hours. And you know what? I said, let's just hang out a day. We'll go to the beach or something and just relax. And we did. We talked about the old times. And both of us were happy that those days are over. He was a lot more heavily entrenched as far as the hierarchy of the mafia. I ran my own crew. He was the actual boss at one time, acting boss of a family. So he was very, very big up there. And him and I were just happy that we made it through that period. I bump into other guys that are active now and then. Hello and goodbye. You know what I mean? I keep it light. I really, if I'm invited to dinner, if I'm invited to go somewhere with them, I don't. I politely decline. You know, we really don't have anything in common. I'm talking about physics and psychology, and they're talking about how they hung somebody out of a window last week who owed them money. So, you know, it's just like, you know, we're on two different planes. And what's interesting is when I do speak with these guys, if I ever did write a television series, and maybe one day someone's going to hire me to write a television series about the mafia, like The Sopranos, because when I bump into these guys and I talk to them for a little while, you know, a couple of minutes even on the street, and then I hop back in my car or whatever, you know, not all the conversations and the slang and the expressions come back to me, because it's all, you know, it's the way I lived until I was 33 years old, until the day I was released from prison. My whole life was around mob from 13 to 33. So you're talking 20 years, day in and day out, around seasoned mobsters, older guys that ran the streets of New York, and including me. I ran it for them at times. You know, and I was the muscle. You know, the big guys didn't get dirty. They wore $5,000 suits and a $20,000 watch, and they sent me and my crew if somebody had to get, you know, roughed up. So I was in it, and all of it comes back when I listen, you know, to a couple of sentences, and then next thing you know, I might come home and I'm talking to my wife, and I'm talking to her, and I'll start saying a couple of expressions, and she'll go, "Did you bump into somebody today?" And I go, "Yeah," it comes out of me again, and then it takes a day or so to wear off again, and I'm back to normal. but anyway, yeah, I found a way, because I never ratted on anybody. I did my time. I did 8.5 years in the penitentiary. I kept my mouth shut. I found a way to sort of, you know, coexist in their world without being part of it, but being able to bump into them and no hard feelings.
Mm. We got just about a minute to go, and I have to ask this, since you brought this up earlier with the recent prison break not too far from where I am here in Montreal, Dannemora in upstate New York, and at the time of this recording at press time, two guys are still at large. Now, you say you had been in that prison yourself before. Were you surprised by this particular outbreak?
I was totally surprised. That's a heavily guarded place. And I will say this, the guards in that place are multi-generational. I remember talking to one of the prison guards in Clinton, and he said to me his grandfather was a prison guard there. You know, there's a small community up there. All the guys do that. And they're tough as nails, those guys up there. They will catch these guys, I know that, but I was surprised because it's a high-security facility, and the guys know what they're doing. But these two guys, you know, they were evil, but smart in a way, because it seems like they definitely planned and plotted well. Pete, let me really quick plug something. I have friends that invited me to speak at the IONS 16th annual conference. It was started by Edgar Mitchell, a famous Apollo 11 astronaut, and I'm speaking there in July 22nd to July 26th in Chicago. If any of your listeners want to go, want to participate in the conference, it's a 4-day conference. It's in Chicago, and the IONS people are just amazing people. Dr. Dean Radin and Dr. Cassandra Vietten are people who like are championing the whole, you know, if I have like precognitive dreams and want to discuss them, they're the scientists who are ready to talk about that. And I think that's pretty courageous of them, you know, because a lot of the scientific community are like, hey, take it easy, you know. But they're not. They're very courageous and adventurous, and my hat's off to them. So if any of your listeners want to participate, go online at IONS, just do a Google search for them, and it'll come up.
Excellent. And again, your book is The 3-Pound Crystal Ball, How the Dream Brain can see the future. And people can also go to your website, which is louisferrante.com. Louis, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us yet again.
Thanks again, Pete. I appreciate it. And the book's available on Amazon, and I hope everyone enjoys it. And feel free to email me, any of you listeners.
Louis Ferrante, author of The 3-Pound Crystal Ball, How the Dreaming Brain Can See the Future. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0304, and you'll find the links to Louis's site, plus also links to that event he's going to be going to in Chicago, and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Does a restaurant have a duty to inspect every food item it serves for foreign objects like metal or even bones? A lawyer suing McDonald's claims his client suffered injuries after eating a chicken McNugget with a bone fragment in it, and he says the restaurant's liable because it doesn't inspect each nugget. Now, McDonald's sells 1.5 billion McNuggets every year. It would be virtually impossible to inspect every nugget unless they used an X-ray machine. And if they did that, they might even be liable for lawsuits over possible radiation in their food. Let's be fair. I suspect that if this man's story is true, McDonald's will do exactly what a restaurant in Washington, D.C. did after it was sued by somebody who cracked a tooth on an olive pit in its salad. Settle and pay the person's medical bill. But did you know that disputes like this don't always need to go to court? A solution can often be reached quicker and less expensively for the person who was injured by using mediation first. If that doesn't work, there's always court. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And this time around, we go to the depths with Stuart Nauman, who is somewhere out there treading water. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. You made it sound like an episode of the Underworld Sea of Jacques Cousteau.
Pretty much.
Yeah. But I never had a calypso.
Okay.
No, no. But you know what? Speaking of water, well, and pools and summer's coming up. This edition of Book Banter, I just wanted to relate to you about the book I'm about to review. You see, when I was much younger, say a little over 40 years ago, I had this morbid fear of the water and swimming in it. In fact, I would prefer the shallow end of the swimming pool rather than the deep end because I feared that I would drown there. Yes, I had that fear of drowning. Also, when I went to summer camp, both day camp and sleepaway camp, I tried to avoid the instructional swim classes because of my fear of drowning in deep water, which I eventually overcame by, let's say, 1975. Award-winning photographer Seth Castile, why I'm mentioning this, well, he's aware of this very scary statistic, that in the United States alone, drowning is the main cause of accidental death among children under 5 years of age. So what he did, in order to promote having infant children take swimming lessons at an early age, thereby reducing the risk of drowning by 88%, he decided to use his camera and show how much fun these infants and toddlers were having underwater at these swimming classes. And the result is his beautiful, charming coffee table book called Underwater Babies. Now, it's not a mythical book. It contains 80 color photographs of babies between the ages of 4 and 17 months as they enjoy swimming underwater and use their natural reflexes to hold their breath while they are underwater. And the first reaction you have when you see these photos is that of amazement, as you see their fearless, joyful expressions on their faces as they experience their brief underwater world. In fact, it looks like they are having a great deal of fun while learning to swim. Some of them look like they've swam for a long time, that they're veterans at this.
Well, it's not like the womb was dry, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, they had a little bit of, in-the-womb training, I guess. And they look quite relaxed while taking the plunge.
I'm sure these were the kids. Let's be honest. The kids that are photographed here, these were the ones who were in the womb doing laps.
Yeah. Or like training for synchronized swimming in the near future, you know, doing like little Esther Williams acts.
Well, no, you can only be synchronized swimming in the womb if you have multiple births.
Well, yeah, maybe they, you know, they were, if they had twins or triplets, yeah, it's very possible.
And by the way, since you bring up the idea of synchronized swimming, I've always wanted to know, if one synchronized swimmer drowned, do they all have to drown?
Well, synchronized drowning? That's an event, Peter.
They want a perfect score, you know? If one goes down, you got to go with the routine.
Yes, but they won't be around to enjoy the triumph of their victory.
Well, be a martyr, what can I say?
We'll see that in Rio, I guess.
Yes. No one wants to go into the water in Rio. That's a whole other story.
Yeah. They'll talk about quagmire, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, others, you know, how to make these pictures much more interesting, there are some babies that are dressed in mermaid costumes, hence the Esther Williams reference, or as deep sea divers and look like they are ready to do an aquatic routine for an Esther Williams movie. Or, a National Geographic documentary, or even the new generation of Jacques Cousteau. You don't know that. So while underwater babies can and will cause a lot of smiles from readers who will leaf through the photos in this book with absolute delight, it also serves as a powerful tool to raise more awareness for their parents to have their children learn to swim at a very early age so that their fear of the water can be dealt with immediately, not to mention reduce the danger of drowning in a pool or a body of water when they're still quite young.
Mm. And this book is?
It's called Underwater Babies by Seth Castile. It's published by Little Brown, and it costs $23.
Now, in all the years you have been on the Stuff File program talking about books on Book Banter, I usually ask you, and is there any other book you can recommend in this vein? And I'll be surprised if you can find one.
Well, there is.
Oh, my God.
Well, because this is not the first underwater-type book that Seth Castile did. He did a book called Underwater Dogs.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, so that started the whole thing. So, and I guess now, I don't know if he did it with cats yet, but I think kids, you know, this is sort of like that, oh, isn't that cute kind of reaction. But if he does it with cats, I'd like to see that. But if you want a book also with cute kids and kids that are used as very interesting photographic subjects, any book by Ann Geddes. It's a perfect book as well.
Mm. I'm guessing maybe Underwater Seniors will be next.
Well, good luck to Seth if he could find someone who could still, float.
They have to be north of 90, I think, to be in the book.
Yes, I think, but it's not a bad idea. So, Seth, if you're listening to this, here's a future subject for a future coffee table book.
Excellent. And again, this book is?
Underwater Babies by Seth Castile, published by Little Brown. It's $23. Makes a great gift anytime, any place, any surface.
And which end of the pool can we find you, sir?
Well, always a shallow end, that's for sure. Or the tiny tots section. But you can see me, if not in the pool, besides the pool, reading the Montreal Times in print or online on my iPad at www.mtltimes.ca.
Excellent, sir. Thank you once again for being on the Stuff File program, sir. Everyone out of the pool.
Yes, and here's the water wings that you loaned me. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program, but we do have time for one more item, and that would be, boys and girls, you know what it is. Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
When Robert Rivas' girlfriend was jailed in Pleasant Grove, Utah, he worked quickly to bail her out. And according to police, the 26-year-old Rivas and 28-year-old Armando Ambriz got the bail money by robbing a credit union. Police were able to identify Ambriz as one of the alleged robbers before even getting a description of him. The bank they robbed was just a couple of blocks away from the police department, according to Lieutenant Britt Smith. Obviously, he stood out like a sore thumb, wearing a wig, fake beard, and fake eyebrows. Ambriz and Rivas were both jailed on suspicion of robbery and obstruction of justice. Rivas' girlfriend was released on bail. I don't know what her plans are now that Rivas is looking at some prison time, Smith said. Well, you know, true love does wait. But seriously, why would someone try to rob a bank so close to the police department while wearing an extremely obvious disguise, all to pay for the bail of someone back at the cop shop? One reason, and one reason only. Okay, in this case, maybe two. One, I mentioned earlier, true love. And the other, they're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0304. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0304. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.